for this evening, Allie from San Diego. I feel tall up here. Let's see. How's that? Can y'all hear me? I'm Allie. I'm an alcoholic, and I got to tell you, I spent the first few, probably 10 minutes here trying to figure out your system that you've got up here. There's a broomstick and duct tape. It looked like something maybe my dad did, so I felt right at home. So, and I guess maybe that's so that I don't like go tumbling into the. Not gonna do it. And I wanna thank John for inviting me to speak here for y'all. And he asked me if I don't know where I picked up y'all. I just did. He asked me if I was nervous, and you know the nervous is this sparkly ring too much for you? The way I feel about speaking is I just get scared to death. But I'm here anyway. As I said, it's a great honor to be here and share what I hope comes across as some experience, strength, and hope. And you know, it's funny, this is a much different room than my first AA meeting that I ever went to. My first AA meeting that I went to was at the MWA Club in Long Beach, California, which is where I got sober. I went to a women's meeting. It was a Thursday night. It had taken me 3 days of being absolutely sick before I could go anywhere. And I went into that meeting absolutely desperate. There were five women there. Two of them were prostitutes, and I'm not talking about like a glamorous kind of prostitute. There's glamorous prostitutes. Anyway, I'm talking about, you know, they didn't put their teeth in to come to the meeting. They're just kind of, you know, down and out. They would talk about how grateful they were to have some beans in the jar, and they had a couple of months of sobriety. And the thing that is so wonderful is that I was so desperate for help that I would sit there and I would listen to these women. And it took me about 2 months before I decided that I didn't need anything that they had to share, and I went elsewhere. And it's probably taken me, you know, all of the rest of this time before I could say, you know what, they really got me to that first place where I felt like I was going to have hope. Because by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely no hope. So that little dark back room with the prostitutes at the MWA Club up on 33rd Street in Long Beach was really the first time that I had felt hope in a really, really, really long time. And I know that there's other people that know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm going to go back a little bit further than that. I actually, my first memories in this life were absolutely idyllic. I was in Europe. My father taught abroad for the University of Maryland. My mother was a preschool teacher part-time. She gardened. We had a Saturday club. I had other little girls come over, and we would do little club things, and she'd have us make projects together. It was all good. I had a tree in the front yard. It was absolutely perfect for climbing. All of this is perfect. Right about the time I was six, my mother left my father. We came to the United States, and life started to change a little bit. My mother met a man, and we moved into a place in northeastern Iowa, very glamorous part of the country. And my mother was going to try self-subsistence farming. So this little shack, and when I call it a shack, I'm not talking about like a little cottage type. I'm talking about a shack. I'm talking about you can see the outside through the slats and in the walls. No running water. And a little furnace. It sounds like something that somebody would make up. And then I walked 20 miles to school in the snow. I'm like, yeah, that's my story right there. I know that one. And I was, as I'm sure you might can understand, I was a little unhappy stuck there in that shack in northeastern Iowa. We didn't have running water, so we certainly didn't have television or anything else like that. And my mother was a very unpredictable woman. She was an Al-Anon, but really, as I look back to her, I think really, if she would have drank every once in a while, I think she could have calmed down and we would have all been happier. But that's not what Al-Anons do, at least not my mother. And my mother was a person whose just anger grew and grew and grew in her. And as this rage grew, our relationship became more and more tense. And I remember coming home one time. I was about 9 years old. I'd been on the school bus, and someone had said a bad word, and I wanted to know what it was, and I asked her. And I remember her just punching me in the stomach, and I remember that feeling of, like, nausea in me and that sense of betrayal. And this is just about where I started thinking, God, I need to get a trip out of this body. I just need to get a ticket out of this body. And this relationship between my mother and me, as I headed into closer to like 12 years old, wasn't getting any better. And I just didn't like reality very much. There's things on my report card where it says, Allie likes to daydream. And I would just constantly be thinking about anywhere else I could be, anywhere away from this nightmare of my life that I could be. I really, really, really needed a drink, but I hadn't had one yet. When I was about 12 years old, my Grammy came out to visit, and about that time, I was just so engulfed in the darkness of my life. I would sit there and I would think about killing myself, and I would think about ways I could get out of where I was, and maybe someday I could go live with my dad. And something happened with my mother, and it was kind of messy, and I had blood all over me. And my Grammy, she got me out of there, and she got me into a boarding school in North Carolina. And I went to that boarding school, and I was like, oh, my God, thank God, life's going to be so much different. I finally got away from my mother. And then it got even better, because then my dad, who was like my knight in shining armor, came out with his beautiful, new, sparkly wife. And they were going to take me to Southern California, and we were all going to live happily ever after. Didn't quite work out that way, but I did go to Southern California. And my father immediately enrolled me in the public school system in Southern California. Well, I know that you'll all be shocked, but I found the wrong people right away. The first time I had a drink, it's funny because I didn't like the taste of it and I couldn't finish that dark beer and I actually threw it out. But for some reason, I knew at like a cellular level that there was something magical in alcohol. And I had to figure out a way to get enough of it into my body so that I could experience that magic. Now, I don't know how I knew this. I was psychic. But I tried again. I tried again with my great friends. And we tried screwdrivers, little vodka and orange juice. Yeah, I was able to drink a whole bunch of that. I was able to throw up on myself all in front of everybody. I did a few other things that evening to somewhat soil my reputation at the local junior high school, but I'm not going to go into detail here because it is a mixed meeting and our stories do disclose in a general way what it used to be like. Needless to say, I didn't have the best reputation after that. And you know, the thing is I remember when I woke up that morning after my first drunk, and I felt that horror, you know? I did not want to face what I had done the night before. I knew my best friend wasn't talking to me anymore, but I couldn't quite figure out why. But it never occurred to me, I better not do that again. What occurred to me quite naturally was, I got to learn how to do that better. I'm going to go ahead and do that again. So that's what I did. I did that for a couple of years down there in Long Beach. I'm sitting there and I learned how to smoke cigarettes, so that I could look cool and I could learn how to hold in pot so I could get super, super high and super, super drunk and stumble around and be really cool with all my friends. My father at that point threw me out of the house. I was about 14 years old. He threw me out of the house and I went and I lived with some friends. And really, honestly, my drinking and drugging not only escalated, but I just was I was a disturbed little kid. I don't know. I spent a lot of years trying to pretend I was something I wasn't. And you know, my first sponsor, she says, you know what the goal is? You got to live in a glass house. And now I stand up here and I talk about these things. But, you know, I mean, I would, my dad would kind of pick me up for dinner and I would wear all black and I'd have white and black hair, kind of like how they're dressing now. But I had, you know, eyeliner out to here, and I would stab safety pins all through my ears. So of course he wanted to take me to the best places. I was just a really messed up little kid. It was recommended by the school counselor. And I was being thrown out of high school at this point for truancy. I just would go basically to first period, and then I would go off about my business. And I was busy. I had a lot of business to do. I had a lot of friends to have meetings with. We had a lot of drinks to consume. So I never made it through the rest of the school periods. But what happened is my school counselor said, you know, she really needs some extra help, and my grandmother said, we'll have her up here in Carmel, California. Now, if you're a Long Beach, L.A. County teenager, you don't want to go to Central California to some little itty-bitty town. And so, you know, I got an idea. Alcoholics get a lot of ideas. The best thing, if you're new to this program, I hope you're out of ideas. You'll get them back. You'll learn how to put things together like broomsticks and duct tape. Let your ideas work for good. But I ran away from home. And that whole experience was a miserable one. My father finally found me 3 days later. I was on a street corner. I was soaking wet. I had been raped. I had had a lot of things happen to me that were going to take a long time to get out of my psyche, if you will. They locked me in my bedroom. They took the doorknobs off the doors so that I couldn't get out. And they had my grandmother come down. And my grandmother came down, and she picked me up, and she took me to Carmel. And I got to tell you, that woman was an absolute saint. Because that woman, by the time she got me, I was a nasty piece of work. Nasty piece of work. All I ever said to her was, F you. I told her I hated her. I told her if I could get away with it, I would kill her. Nice, huh? And she would look at me and she would say, I don't care what you say to me, there is nothing you can do to make me not love you. And what a gift to experience someone that can love you like that when you are at your most unlovable. And this was this incredible gift that I had, and this incredible gift that God gave me, is in the midst of all of this darkness, I had this woman who loved me so much it didn't make any difference what I looked like or whether I tried to wear her tablecloths to school. She was going to love me anyway. I grew up, kind of. I went into the airlines, and I almost got kicked out of the airlines because you know what we do? Our drinking is escalating, and I'm gonna show up, and I'm gonna be really good for you. I'm gonna be really, really well behaved, and then right at that crucial point when I've gotta like be on a flight or something like that, I'm gonna drink all night and show up reeking like alcohol, and they don't like that when you're a flight attendant. But I worked for an airline that was going through, this is Eastern Airlines, so if any of you remember that, it was a million years ago. I got laid off, and there was something about my Grammy that was going on that wasn't right. And so I flew back out, and I stayed with my Grammy. And I got there at, right around mid-August, and September 2nd, my Grammy killed herself. And that changed a lot of stuff for me. It changed the way I believed in God. because I did believe in God. But at that moment when she killed herself, and for a long time afterwards, I couldn't believe in God anymore. You know, it talks about in the We Agnostics in the Big Book about how sometimes our belief of God is obscured by calamity. That's one calamity that obscured God from me. It's not that he wasn't there anymore, but I couldn't see him because she's the only stable force that I'd ever had. She was the one that, no matter what, would love me. And she was gone. And I remember that sense of desolation, and there was only one thing that would fill that desolation. Do y'all know what that was? It was alcohol. And this may be controversial when I say this to you, but I got to tell you that for me, I'm glad I had that. I don't know what I would have done in that period of time if I didn't have that alcohol, but I can tell you that what it did for me is it changed the way that I drank. Alcohol became, on top of everything else, my comforter. And so I remember for days, months, just drinking and drinking and drinking. I ended up leaving Carmel and coming back down to Southern California. And really, I'm back into this controlled drinking. I like to go to fancy bars and fancy restaurants and drink out of nice wine glasses because that was kind of a different thing. You know, if I drank it out of a nice glass, then the thing is, and the beautiful thing is for me, it didn't make any difference where I started or who I was drinking with. It always ended up being a mess. I remember I would get into fights, for example, and I remember calling my dad up, and I'm all drunk, and I'm calling him, and I'm going, and I got my butt kicked tonight. And my dad says, you know what, Allie, you go out, and you drink the way you do, and you hang out with the people you hang out with. Don't be calling me when you get your butt kicked. It's going to happen. And I just had a life that was getting more and more and more out of control. I didn't start out a daily drinker. I started out drinking on the weekends, and obviously when things happened, I would, you know, drink through them. But what happened for me is my weekends started to miraculously grow. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So all of a sudden Thursday is, you know, part of your weekend, and then Wednesday. And by the time you get to Monday, of course, you're grieving for the weekend. So you got to have a drink. It's not that hard to add Tuesday. And I know that there were times when, you know, when Joel was talking, he was talking about his mom talking to the German lady. And I got to say, I remember my best friend saying to me, because we'd all gone to San Francisco, and we were out, it was about 5 o'clock, and I needed a drink. And I was with all these people that weren't alcoholics. So they didn't understand. I needed a drink, and they were saying, okay, just a little while, just a little while, just a little while, just a little while. And I just stopped, and I said, damn it, I need a drink now. We had to go into the bar. We had to have a drink. And my best friend's having this talk with me, and she's saying, you know, I see you get into some trouble in your life, and you drink a lot. Do you think that maybe alcohol might be a problem for you? And my head turned around probably about 12 times. And I said, don't you ever bring that up to me again. Because, you see, I had gotten that I couldn't live without alcohol. There was I do dog rescue today, and there was a dog rescue that was happening, and this gal that was trying to intervene on an alcoholic that had the dog said, this gal won't stop drinking. She says she needs to drink. It's the only thing that can keep her stable. And I thought, I know exactly how she's feeling. I know exactly what it feels like when your entire life has gone to hell in a handbasket, and the only thing you have is the alcohol. You're not going to give that up. It's your only comfort. But back to me. The thing is that I also had in me, I had this like crazy rage. And if I would wake up the next morning and I'd done something especially psychotic, it was really kind of disturbing for me. However, chasing strangers through the parking lot, crawling on top of their cars and banging on the windshields and doing stuff like that. I'd do stuff like that, and then I'd wake up the next morning and I'd go, why did I do that? Why did I act that way? You know the part in the big book where it says dangerously antisocial? That was me. Although it's funny because there's a part too that it talks about being a psychotic, and I thought, well, that's not me. I'm the one where I'm normal in every other respect. And like our previous speaker, it never occurred to me to try to stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking. I wanted to stop being violent in public. I wanted to stop taking my clothes off in public. I wanted to drink and be socially acceptable. And so I tried. Like, I had the mental obsession. Besides the fact that I had a mountain of evidence to the contrary, I believed that I could go out that night and drink normally. Every single day I went through this work. Today it's going to be different. Today it's going to be different. Today it's going to be different. There was a day where I decided I wasn't going to drink one day. I'm just not going to drink today, is what I said. Today I'm going to choose not to drink. I actually like it when people say that in AA meetings because I think, oh yeah, I did that too. Did I drink that day? I did. See, the thing about alcoholics like myself, we've lost the power of choice. And by the time I got to that drink, I lasted till about 9 o'clock at night, which I think actually at that point was pretty darn stinking good. But people were begging me, have a drink. I was a wino. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you didn't have wine, I'll drink whatever you have. I'll drink your lighter fluid, really, if you don't have wine. But for whatever reason, I would never get rid of my bottles. And I had a storage room about the size of that little anteroom there, and I just put those bottles in that storage room. Well, if you drink like I drink, it doesn't take long before you've got bottles up to the ceiling. You know what I'm saying? And it's not very good when people open that door. It's kind of like Bluebeard's, wife opening with the bottle. What the heck? I'm recycling for the entire city. And I got to tell you, actually, when I got sober, I cleaned out that back room. I got all those empty bottles, and I did that walk of shame down to the dumpster, and I'm throwing those bottles. It must have only taken me about 300 trips. And all of a sudden, I see the bottles come. They're coming the other way. And it is my downstairs neighbor, and there it's like they do recycle, and this is like they've hit the bonanza. So, yeah, right? I'm telling you. So, I don't know. I still do not know why I got sober. I don't know why I got sober. What I wanted was I wanted to die. I really wanted to die. I hated the woman I'd become. I would sit there with my glass of wine looking at, there's a June bug in here, and if it gets anywhere near me, I am going to run screaming for the back of the room, just saying. Don't know how that'll come across on the CD, but so thinking about the June bug now. Okay, where are you? Big room full of people. So it was another Monday night, and I wasn't going to drink much that day. And then I thought to myself, I had a guest in town. Maybe I'll just go down after all my guests in town. Just going to go down and we'll have a nice glass of wine. So how did this night go? Did we stay at that nice little restaurant? No. We went to another nice restaurant and then to a slightly less nice restaurant. Then we went to the hole in the wall in the corner. by the end of the night, she had a bloody nose. You know, I mean, as I said, it was just another Monday night. The thing is something happened. I don't know what it was. Something happened, but I woke up the next morning, and I'm like, I can't drink anymore. I cannot drink anymore. Now, if that isn't divine intervention, I don't know what it is. Because remember, that's what I do. In fact, I don't want to hear about not drinking. You're going to beg me to drink. But there was, I was really too sick to actually go anywhere for a little while. So I had friends bring me my supplies, which is like a Big Mac meal or something like that, and Diet Pepsi. I mean, how did I survive myself, right? I drank like a fish, and all I ate was McDonald's foods and Diet Pepsi. Never drank. I mean, I didn't have water for 30 years. I didn't have water. Here I am. You know how they say that you're supposed to drink 8 glasses of water a day or else? Well, I'm here to tell you. So I go into AA. I know that you've got to find a sponsor. My first sponsor, actually, and I usually don't bring her up, she was a gal by the name of Patty. God bless Patty. I mean, I was one of those. I mean, I called her like, I must have called her 27 times a day. I'm having a feeling and I don't know what to do about it. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And she, by the time I told her I was actually getting another sponsor, she said, I think that's a good idea. I know that paybacks are a... So one of the first things I tell really new girls that I sponsor is like, get lots of phone numbers. You can call other people. Because otherwise, I know I'm going to get one of those one of these days that's going to call me 27 times a day and tell me about every stinking feeling that she's having. But I get this. I get another sponsor. Her name is Dodie G. She's from Long Beach. If any of you have been up there, she speaks a lot. She's absolutely fabulous. I chose her because she was funny, and I wanted someone funny. I wanted somebody to entertain me, right? Now, it's funny because even though I came in here and I was desperate, I still felt like I knew a lot more than you guys. And if I could just get all of this booze out of my system so that I could actually speak clearly, I could lead y'all up to the mountaintop and bequeath you with my spiritual principles. I knew a lot more than. As a matter of fact, if you had asked me to speak back then, I would have been running up here for 2 hours. I would have told you exactly how to live your life. My sponsor would say, well, you sure do know it all. I guess you don't need me. But, my sponsor, she would say, I don't care how crazy you are, I'll still keep sponsoring you. And I would think, sit there and go, why'd she say that to me? Is that just like a spiel she gives to everybody? Because I think I'm looking pretty good here compared to everybody else. You know how it talks like we're run by fear and delusion? I had a lot of those delusions. And I also had a lot of fear. You know that story about how you're driving in a station wagon when you're drinking, just an analogy, and you're eating all kinds of food and you're throwing your trash in the back. Then you get sober, you hit the brakes and everything comes up into the front seat, hits you on the back of the head, it's on your dashboard everywhere. Well, that's what happened for me as well. I had so much fear. I was so afraid. I was afraid of all kinds of stuff. I was afraid of economic insecurity. And you want to know what happened to me? Well, I quit my job because I had an idea. And then I didn't have any more money. Don't know how those two go together. Cause and effect completely went over the top of my head. But they were going to take my car. They were going to take my condo. They were going to, take my dog. I was scared to death. The best thing I could do half the time is go to meetings, and the rest of the time I just sleep. Meetings, sleep. Meetings, sleep. That was my life for a while. And you know what? I got through it. same way as everybody else gets through anything. I was afraid of being left for another woman. That was another big one. Scared to death of being left for another woman. And you know what? That happened too. Now, I'm not going to say when that didn't happen that I didn't get on my hands and knees and sob and it pretty much looked like I was eating the carpet. But I got through that one too. I was afraid of my dog dying. And my dog died. And I got to say, out of the three of those, I still miss the dog. Okay? That's right. My first sponsor said, she goes, you know what you need? You need to find someone, a baby. That's what she called them, babies. You got to find yourself a baby that's real sick. And that's what's going to help you. She goes, I want you to get down on your knees every night and pray for a baby. So I'd get down on my knees every night and I'd pray for a baby, and I got me a baby. So I had this idea about the kind of girl that I was going to sponsor. And she was going to be real cute and well put together, and she was going to be like a little sister, and we were going to go do stuff together. I don't know, you tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous, does God have a sense of humor? This girl, just, I mean, she was tall, she was awkward, she would follow me around. She would eat so much sugar, her tongue would swell up in her mouth and she would talk funny. I don't have to exaggerate anything, I'm telling you the truth here. And she had, in addition to her alcohol problem, she'd had a little cocaine problem, and her nose ran all the time, and she would not use a Kleenex to save her life. That girl would... Now, because she was my first sponsee, I somehow didn't get the whole part that maybe I should just do what my sponsor did with me, which is to, like, meet in your house, you read the big book, you work the steps, you go to meetings, you know, you introduce them to some other people in AA. No, I thought I had to do some kind of extreme makeover. Well, let's start with your diet. So we went to the store, and I'm walking down the aisle. I'm telling you, she's like following along behind me. That's when you run into your, like, the people that you know that aren't in the program. Hi, Allie, who's your friend? I cleaned her house for her. She's not in San Diego. I'm going to tell you, her first name is Christine, and I know this is online, so please forgive me, Christine, but you know it's true that you're hearing it. She is still sober today, if you can believe that. And she used Kleenex, too! Stayed sober and uses Kleenex. And I taught her the joys of frozen meals, you know, instead of just those fruit pies. You know what I'm talking about, those little Hostess fruit pies. Right around, I had about 3 years sober, and I just got real sad. I don't know how else to put it. I just got real, real sad. And my therapist told me she was going to put me in the booby hatch. I didn't want to be in the booby hatch. No offense to any other boobies out there. I went to my sponsor's house that night. I was in hiding. And she's like, don't worry. They're not going to put you in the crazy bin. I'm not going to let them put you in the crazy bin. You know how long it took me to get into the crazy bin? One day. I was one day later, I was there. But I brought my big book with me. I'll tell you the thing, and the reason that I bring up this story is that, you know, it's interesting. I was sponsoring at the time. I'd been working the steps. I lost my marbles and I still didn't drink. And really, when you think about it, and you think about where I was when I first got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and how I couldn't make it an entire day without drinking, and there I am, and I lose my marbles, and I'm in the booby hatch. I drop my basket, however you want to put it, and I stayed sober. I didn't drink, you know? And that really is the beauty of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I didn't have to drink through that. And my sponsor at the time used to say, she goes, that's not a nervous breakdown, that's a nervous breakthrough. Because it was... It was right about that time that I started to learn, maybe I don't know everything. And I started to realize that maybe I could learn a thing or two, and this is very important if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have to do everything perfectly and get an A+ and always look great no matter what. In fact, right before I had my little nervous breakthrough, a woman with a lot of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous came up to me and said, you're going to have to kill Barbie before she kills you. You know, It's something I don't usually start with, like, what my life's like today, especially if there's people that are newer in the room, because really, one of the things that I was the most afraid of when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was of being bored. I was scared to death of boredom. Oh my, death or Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's kind of like the part in the book where it tells us that we have but two choices. One is to continue to drink, obliterating our miserable existence, and the other one is to accept a spiritual way of life, because Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. And only an alcoholic of my variety, and perhaps some of you, would sit there and go, I don't know, death's a little bit more final, I'll try the AA thing for a while. Really, I have to say that I think that if I had to say one thing that has saved my butt more than anything, it is sponsoring people. Now, I don't mean teaching them how to use Kleenex, because that woman, no, maybe it was the next girl that I sponsored that wore me out. Trying to do the extreme makeover on the girls that I sponsored was something that wore me out really quickly. But actually being of service, which is to sit down with someone, read the big book with someone for the umpteenth time in your living room, listen to their fifth steps, do all that stuff that I do, I don't know what that is, but for whatever reason, that is the stuff that I see when people get long-term sobriety that keeps you sober. And besides, I got to tell you, who do you think brought me bean and cheese burritos when I was in the booby hatch? Those are my sponsees. I have a great debt to my first sponsor, because she taught me that from the beginning. Right after she said the thing about me being crazy, she did say what we were going to do is we were going to meet each week, we were going to read the big book together, we were going to work the steps, and once I was to step 12, I was going to go out there and I was going to start working with someone else, and that is the way we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned that, and I knew that, and she set me up with that from the get-go, and the girls that I sponsor, it's the same thing from the get-go. You don't have to wear sparkly rings like me. You don't have to do the stuff that I do outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you want to have long-term sobriety, you got to work with others, because that's really the work in this program, is when we take this message and we share it with others out there. And that's why, by the way, I accept speaking commitments even when I'm scared to death, because it is sharing a message. I don't know what kind of a message it is, but, you know... And I'm a big book thumper. You can kind of tell, because my big book's all falling apart. But I believe when I tell people that are new, that are looking for a sponsor, I say, you know what, look for someone that's got a good used big book. Don't trust the people that have never touched their big book. That's where the program is. Listen to the crazy lady. The thing for me that I do and that I did, for instance, today is I start each day with prayer and meditation, just like it says in the book, upon awakening. And I do that because otherwise I am driven by the feelings inside me that I don't even look at. That's what I did when I was out there and I was drinking. I didn't want to feel anything, so I was going to drink, and I was going to go out, and I was going to get some excitement. And let me tell you, when I get excitement, it's a lot of excitement. A little bit too much excitement. Actually, some people call it just chaos. But when I sit down, like for instance today, I was scared to come and speak in front of y'all. And I sat down, I sat in prayer and meditation, and I felt that fear, and it felt like this cold, hard nugget of fear. And I found that there is nothing I can do to help myself with my own fear other than to take it to God and just go, I don't know what I'm going to do in front of this. I don't know what I'm going to do in front of these people. I'm going to stand up there, and I'm going to feel like I'm going to pee myself, and you've got to give me something to say so that I don't do the other, or I don't go diving off into the front row. But I am very, very grateful, not only to Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I want to say is the way of life that it has given me. Right before I got sober, my dad said, he says, you know what? He says, I know, he says, that you're out there looking for meaning. He says, I see how desperate you are to get some meaning in your life. And he says, but honey, you know, you're never going to find it in the bottom of a bottle. He said to me, and at the time, I was 29 years old. I was 20 pounds less than I am today. I was drinking myself to death. And right after I got sober, there was a gal, same age as me. Same age as me, except she had two little twin girls that were 2 years old. She even drank what I drank. She was a wino. And she was pregnant with cirrhosis. You know what I'm talking about? Have you seen? And she didn't make it. She died. She drank like me. She had my story, except she had those two little girls. I don't know why I woke up one morning and said, I can't do this anymore. I got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I sure am glad that you were here. I sure am glad that those women in that room, the MWA Club, were there. I'm grateful to my sponsor that listened to my idiocy day in and day out, month in and month out, and all my great ideas. And I'm just really, really grateful for this way of life and my sobriety. My birthday is actually coming up. It's next Thursday. It's July 29th, 1997. I'll have 13 years. I'll actually be a teenager. I know a lot less than I ever have in my life, except that I like sparkly things. And that's all I've got. Again, thanks so much.